JSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello to you all. Thank you for being with us. Welcome to Viewpoints. Boris Chassin here with you for the next 30 minutes. On today's show, greater autonomy or devolution is granted to Nunavut. What does it mean and how could it be applied to the region of northern BC?
One of the things that this agreement does, in addition to transferring power and authority to the territory, it also provides funding to build capacity so that Nunavut can actually manage resource development. It was something that was done by the federal government before. And it's always been a big issue in the territorial level, is their ability to actually, you know, have the administrative capacity, the financial capacity to undertake these responsibilities.
The Vista Radio Group absorbs 21 interior BC radio stations from BCE.
We intend to keep everybody and actually grow the size of the workforce, because I think most of them are underutilized. People who say no one listens to radio really don't know what they're talking about. In fact, tuning has actually gone up, not down. Radio's not dead. We're doing well.
And the Haldimand Township crier is looking to retire. Anyone up for the job?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide. This episode of Viewpoints is a rerun.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Follow us on X at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
So February 13th, it was World Radio Day, and a great pretext for us to talk to you about the state of radio this week. We've all heard the news. Bell Canada Enterprises, or BCE, dropped 45 regional stations across Canada this February 2024, provoking the fury of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Heritage Minister Pascal Saint-Onge and many others as well. However, some good news came out of that announcement. Several other media companies are stepping up to buy the abandoned Bell stations. Hopefully, the employees of some of those stations will still have a job with the new owners. With headquarters in Courtenay, BC, Vista announced its intent to take over 21 of the BCE stations located in BC's interior. Vista also owns 50 other radio stations in three Canadian provinces and the Northwest Territories. The purchase is pending CRTC approval, which could take about a year to approve. Unlike Bell, Vista's primary focus is radio. While taking us through this significant expansion, Vista President Brian Edwards claims many of these markets are underutilized. Edwards wants to bring his decentralized news model to the stations with the intent of bettering local news coverage. Here's an excerpt from his conversation with journalist Ian Craig in British Columbia.
Brian, this expansion will take on roughly 80 new employees. What kind of logistics are you planning in order to manage this exponential growth?
Well, there's a lot of things. First of all, most of the stations are, well, all of the stations today are computerized and on various platforms. So while we wait for the commission, we'll be formatting stations with new equipment, so that we can just move our stuff in and move Bell stuff out on the day of close. In terms of people, we'll certainly be talking to people over the course of time. It's a long time to wait. This one could be up to a year. So, you know, we've already sent messages out that we intend to keep everybody and actually grow the size of the workforce, because I think these markets, most of them are underutilized. And that's going to be our approach. We have stations in Ontario, Alberta, British Columbia, and Northwest Territories.
How do you think the media landscape in these regions will be altered with this transfer? Will there be an increased focus on local news content, for example?
Oh, absolutely. That's been the key of our success. Our people live in the communities that they work in, obviously, and we're part of the community, for sure. And if you're part of a community, obviously what's going on in that community is very important. So local news for us is number one. In fact, we carry less than 10% national news on our radio stations, because everyone has access to national news in many, many forms. So why repeat something that is available somewhere else?
And it seemed like with the larger corporations, especially local news, was something that just didn't have much of a focus. In that theme, I'd like to quote recent comments by Premier David Eby. He said, "Corporations like Bell have overseen the assembly of local media assets that are treasures to local communities." And he went on, "They bought them up like corporate vampires. They sucked the life out of them, laying off journalists. They've overseen the crapification of local news by laying off journalists. And now they say it's no longer economically viable to run these local radio stations. It's no longer economically viable to have investigative news." I'm curious, Vista Radio is certainly much bigger than our own station, like a little nonprofit, but it's also much smaller than something like Bell Media, a large media entity within Canada, one of the big three telecom giants. Where do you see Vista's role within the Canadian media landscape?
Well, I think the simplest answer I can give you is that we are focused on one business stream, and that's small and medium market radio, along with each of those stations has a web presence, obviously. It is the era of digital. But we don't have any other business streams. So our focus is totally, and our livelihood is totally dependent on good local radio. And that's, I think, the difference between how we operate those stations and how a larger corporation might operate them. Let me expand on that, because this is a huge difference between the way we operate and many other companies. We have local management in almost every community. And if we don't have management in a community, it's found in an adjacent community where there's another station of ours. Those people make a lot, like 90% of the decisions of what goes on the air, what charities we're going to promote, what community events that'll be on the air, places that we go, in the community. So all of that's local. And, you know, a lot of corporations kind of over-centralize their management, and we've done the opposite, which is why I think we've been successful. People who say no one listens to radio really don't know what they're talking about. In fact, tuning, since people have gone back to work, has actually gone up, not down. That'll be because of travel time in larger markets. But radio's not dead. We're doing well.
In the province of Quebec, Arsenal Media also took a bite at BCE stations. It announced its intention to grab seven new radio stations from BCE, which would make Arsenal the biggest radio player in Quebec with 25 private regional radio stations.
Follow us on X at CanadaLJI and listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
We now move to the northeast of the country, to Nunavut, which has furthered the process of devolution. This means that the Nunavut territory will now have strengthened autonomy over its services, development of resources, and sovereignty. On January 18, the Nunavut government, Nunavut Tungavik Incorporated, and the Canadian government signed the Nunavut Lands and Resource Devolution Agreement. The concept of devolution, independence, or sovereignty has been gaining momentum as well in British Columbia. Here again is Ian Craig in Prince George, British Columbia, speaking with Dr. Gary Wilson, UNBC's Political Science Department Chair, talking about the significance of this process for the territory since Nunavut's establishment in 1999, and also how devolution could apply to the Northern Territories in British Columbia.
Dr. Gary Wilson, this is significant news for Canada's largest territory. Nunavut already has a number of agreements in place that lead it to be a little more autonomous than other regions of Canada. But ultimately, what does this agreement mean for the territory and for Canada?
Well, ultimately what it means is that the territory of Nunavut and the government of Nunavut will have control over resource development over most public lands, crown lands in the territory, which is a fairly significant move. It's the sort of last piece of the puzzle in devolution for Nunavut. The other territories, Northwest Territories and Yukon, have already gone through devolution processes over the last couple of decades, and both of those territories gained control over over natural resources and resource development some time ago. So Nunavut was the outlier. It hadn't yet taken over that area, that really important area. And this agreement will set the stage for that. So it doesn't mean it will be an immediate takeover. It will likely happen in 2027. But the agreement has been signed, and now we begin kind of the implementation phase of that and the transfer phase. One of the things that this agreement does, in addition to transferring power and authority to the territory, it also provides funding to build capacity so that Nunavut can actually manage resource development. Was something that was done by the federal government before. And it's always been a big issue in the territorial level is their ability to actually, you know, have the administrative capacity, the financial capacity to undertake these responsibilities. So part of the agreement is funding arrangements from the federal government, both annual and one time, that will look to build capacity within the government of Nunavut so they can actually carry out these devolved responsibilities.
It's a really interesting arrangement, and it took many years to get to this point. I mean, Nunavut became a territory in 1999.
Yep.
Now we're looking at 25 years later. This is a milestone moment in that process of developing a devolution and closer to autonomous sovereignty.
It is. I mean, you know, some people might argue that it should have happened a lot sooner, but at the same time, you don't want to devolve too quickly, right? Because, as I said, the capacity to take on these responsibilities was not there. And that sort of sets a place up for failure if you devolve powers and then they're not administered properly because you lack capacity. So I think this is a better approach, right, where you make sure that you have the things in place that are necessary to develop that capacity.
In the context of sovereignty, autonomy, and devolution, as these concepts interlace and overlap with each other, are we now looking at Nunavut as a more sovereign entity than it was prior?
Yes, you are. I mean, they have greater control over what happens in the territory. And when I say they, I mean the government of Nunavut, but by extension, the people of Nunavut, which elect that government, right? And the vast majority of the people living in Nunavut are Inuit. About 85% of the population is Inuit, the Nunavimiut. And they essentially are now in control over a whole series of different policy areas, and their government is in control of these areas. So yeah, it's almost playing into the self-determination of Inuit in the Eastern Arctic in the territory of Nunavut. It's reinforcing that self-determination and that control and that sovereignty. So, I mean, that's really what the territories have been looking for ever since the 1960s, right? They've been looking to have control over the things that happen in their territorial spaces. And this is largely finished now as a result of this agreement.
Perhaps to lay it out a little bit for our audience, why might this be significant for Nunavut itself, say in terms of healthcare or other services that the territory might deliver for its population?
It kind of boils down to local people having control, like local governments or governments that are closer to the people having control over what happens in a territory rather than being told what to do by some distant government.
What are the important distinctions between autonomy and devolution as a concept?
Well, so devolution is where a central government, in our case the federal government, devolves or hands over power to another government, in this case a territorial government, where that territorial government didn't have that authority before. That's a bit different from what the provinces enjoy, because if you look at the responsibilities of the provinces, you know, provinces control things like healthcare and education, resource development, but all that is laid out in the Constitution of Canada in various constitutional documents, and it's protected legally by the Constitution. With the territories, they don't have that kind of legal protection. So it is possible at some point in the future that the federal government would take back some of these powers. It's highly unlikely now that they've given them over, but it is always possible. Whereas if you have a sort of constitutionally entrenched powers, the federal government can't do that without getting the agreement of the provinces. So there is a kind of a legal difference there between territories and provinces. But as I said before, if you look at the powers and the authority of provinces and territories now, they are very similar in terms of the types of things that they can do, the kinds of responsibilities that they have as governments.
If we shift our focus over closer to our own regional area of, say, northern British Columbia, the provincial government and even the federal government has been negotiating with various First Nations across the province over territorial claims, traditional territory, and, of course, asserting rights and sovereignty within these various areas. If we were to look at the concept of devolution in northern BC, what kind of changes could we see between our government and First Nations, or even industry and First Nations?
Well, we can certainly think about devolution in the context of Indigenous self-determination and the move towards signing, you know, treaties or land claims agreements, right? So that's been a trend now that's been happening since the 1970s. A number of different Indigenous groups across Canada have signed these treaties. The Nisga, for example, signed one in the 1990s that gave them a certain degree of control over their land and political system and so on. So we can certainly think about it in terms of that aspect, right? So if the Clickley Nation in northern BC signed a treaty with the federal and provincial governments, that would essentially devolve and hand over powers that had previously been under the control of the federal and provincial governments. The other thing that we can think of is sort of more broadly within northern BC. So northern BC is a vast region. It's a northern region. It has much in common with the territories in terms of geography and climate and demography and all of these kinds of things. And one of the unique features of the way that the Canadian system works is that the provincial norths, places like northern BC, northern Saskatchewan, and so on, don't have anywhere near the same level of autonomy as the territories now do. So we have an imbalance here in the Federation, in my opinion, and it's always been a bit of a grievance, I think, in the North, right? We are essentially under the control of the provincial government here. There is no sort of autonomous territory of northern BC, whereas if you go above the 60th parallel, those territories are now essentially provinces, right? So the people living within the territories live in a place that has quite robust autonomy over a wide variety of different policy areas. That doesn't exist in northern BC. I mean, you could envision maybe in the future, you know, and this might be a little bit difficult to envision, but kind of a separate province of northern BC where we would have our own political system here, we would have control over resource development, we would have control over healthcare and education, rather than having to answer to Victoria and the powers in southern BC. It's just a thought, but it's something that's kind of been there ever since I've been in northern BC. It's been a matter of discussion about providing northern communities and northern regions with greater autonomy over what happens in their region. Countries, say, in the circumpolar north, which I'm most familiar with, if you look at countries like Russia, for example, or the Nordic countries in Scandinavia, you see that there are a whole variety of different models for trying to realize greater local self-government or regional self-determination. Some of these are nested, as you said, where there's kind of an autonomous region existing within a larger unit. So in the kind of equivalent in BC might be, say, an autonomous region of northern BC existing within the province of BC. In other places, it's a little bit different. If you look at places like Norway and Sweden, say Indigenous peoples there have gone a different route. They've created national parliaments, Indigenous parliaments that serve as advisory bodies to the national government on matters of Indigenous issues. So it really depends on the country in question, and we could go into a lot of detail about why that is, but I'll leave it at that for there. One interesting example that's a little closer to Canada is Greenland, for example. Greenland is part of Denmark, but it is an autonomous sovereign entity that is within the Danish crown. and it is moving towards statehood. It isn't quite there yet, but it essentially has control over most internal matters relating to Greenland, including things like, you know, resource development. And that, you know, is sort of where we're seeing the territories going. Although it's important to note that in all these cases, the government of Greenland, the government of Northwest Territories, Yukon, Nunavut, all of these are public governments, right? So the governments that are in charge represent all of the residents living in that particular territory, not just the indigenous representatives. But in many cases, the vast majority of the people living in those regions are indigenous, so they become sort of de facto indigenous governments.
Interesting.
So there's lots of models out there that we could look to. I think in general, Canada is ahead of most countries in terms of now recognizing indigenous sovereignty, indigenous self-determination through things like land claims agreements and treaties, through some of the legal cases that have been passed, and also in our constitution. And then now, of course, through devolution, the devolution of power to the territorial governments.
Thank you for going into some detail, and I appreciate your time, Dr. Gary Wilson. This has been great.
You're listening to Viewpoints with Warish Sesang. Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
This episode of Viewpoints is a rerun. To close our show, we turn to Ontario, where the Alnwick Haldimand Township will soon need a new town crier. The man who currently is filling the position is leading the charge to find his replacement. Liam Cragg recently announced his pending retirement later this year after having volunteered for the job since 2016. Though the role is ceremonial, Cragg insists it's not without importance, as the town crier is an ambassador for the town. Here's a very short excerpt from Jeff Scar's 25-minute conversation with town crier Liam Cragg.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Currently, a town crier is some pageantry and a ceremony that various towns around the world have named as part of their township or city. But it developed from way back when in England with the bellman. And I'm sure you've heard in the movies, 12 o'clock and all's well. And that's when the bellman would have patrolled around the towns and villages to check for fires in the thatched roofs, because street lighting was done by incandescents. So
great. So you're winding down your role, right? And you hope to find a replacement.
Yeah, well, at this stage right now, I'm trying to find a replacement for council.
Yeah.
And ideally what I'd like to do is have a short list presented to them to say, here's who I've found that might be suitable, and then have a competition for council, and have some fellow criers in from our surrounding areas to help judge the event and make recommendations to council.
Great. Well, let's first go back to how you got, I believe we're in a competition to become a town crier elsewhere, and you didn't get the gig at that time, but tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it all started off back near the turn of the millennium when the Rotary Club of Bracebridge said for our Santa Claus parade float, the theme was communication. And past Premier Frank Miller said, okay, I've got a great idea. Liam, you get dressed up as a crier and you lead the pickup truck that'll have a mock-up of a satellite in the back of it. And there we've covered it from A to Z. The mayor at that time, Scotty Northmore, was so thrilled. He said, let's see if we can get a crier. So there were two entrants, myself and Bruce Krueger, and Bruce won. And Bruce has been a tremendous attribute to the Guild of Town Criers since that time. And then when I moved down here almost 10 years ago, and I was on the Heritage Committee, and I suggested we should do something similar. Long story short, they came to me and said, we don't want to have a competition. Would you be interested? So here I am today.
Yes. What was it that appealed to you about being a town crier?
There's the pageantry of it.
Yep.
There is definitely lots associated. I mean, you can even go to crier. Our guild is... gets requests occasionally from the royal pageant master over in England, Bruno Peake, who will say, okay, we're doing a VJ Day celebration. Can you please get the word out to the various legions? Here's what we want to do, and there will be a cry that you can read that's standardized throughout the world. Separate for England and then the rest of the world. And the reach of the criers is interesting. I mean, there are criers in the States. There are criers on the East Coast, the West Coast. And Ontario Guild is well regarded internationally because town crier for Kingston, Chris Wyman, is a three-time world champion. And We hold up very well at competitions internationally. There has to be a drive to say, I want to be an excellent representative for our community. That's the number one. You know, I love my community. I love where we are. I love what it is. And I want to reflect that when I go out into public. So that's the number one thing. The number two thing is to, yes, have a good voice. But even voice, you can get your voice trained. Don't limit yourself to, I know it all and I can do it all. Go out and experience what other people are doing and how they do things and learn something.
It's been fantastic to have you in today. I really appreciate your time.
Jeff, thank you so much for having me in. I really appreciate the interest you've shown.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, Liam is hoping to find a next town crier as soon as this year. He'll even provide some training. There's more where that came from. Jeff Gard spent almost an entire half hour with the town crier. Tune in at frequencynews.ca for more. And you can write to us, radio@frequencynews.ca, radio@frequencynews.ca. And that's it for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists Jeff Gard and Ian Craig. To our national editors Victoria Fenner and Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada, located in Ottawa. I'm Boris Chassagne, your host and producer in Montreal. Thanks for being with us, and until next week, ciao. This episode was a rerun.
With Viewpoints. at Canada LJI.